You are listening to a sermon by Janice Kreider recorded on February 3, 2008 at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Some of our neighbors down the street still have their Christmas tree blazing in their front window. And I wondered, why are they still having this tree there? But as I was preparing this talk, I got the answer. Maybe, anyway. We're nearly halfway between Christmas and Easter. And today is the last Sunday of Epiphany, which is the post-Christmas season. And Wednesday, coming up, is Lent, which is the very beginning of the pre-Easter season. So the other thing about the text today in the lectionary, it's in the midpoint of the Gospels. So that's true in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So it makes sense that today we would have this text, because we're midway between Christmas and Easter. And I'm looking for my neighbors to take their tree down in the next day or two. So keep the idea of between in the back of your mind. Now, what I wish I had was kind of a video clip of this account, this story, this thing that happened. It would be much better than trying to talk about it. But briefly, the story, we've sung about it already, but it's just told briefly. Jesus and his three favorite disciples climbed a mountain, and Jesus began to look very different. His face lit up, and his clothes became a dazzling white. And then two figures appeared, Moses and Elijah, and the disciples recognized them. And these were long-dead Old Testament characters. Peter offered to make dwellings for the two Old Testament characters and for Jesus, but his offer was interrupted by two events. The first was this bright cloud that covered them, and then the voice that came out of the cloud. And the voice frightened the three disciples, and they fell to the ground. Basically, I think they had a panic attack here. The next thing they knew, Jesus touched them and said, "Get up and do not be afraid." And then it's all over, and the three disciples didn't see anything except Jesus. And when they went down the mountain, Jesus told them not to tell anyone about it until after he'd been raised from the dead. So you might want to look in your bulletins, because I want to go into a little more detail about these verses. The first verse in Matthew 17:1 talks about 6 days. Well, 6 days after what? Well, it's not totally clear, but what happened before were two things that involved Peter. Peter's confession that Jesus was Christ, the Son of the living God, and Peter's rebuke of Jesus telling that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer. So those are the things that happened before. In the passage in Luke, it says that they went up onto a mountain to pray. It doesn't tell us that in Matthew. And verse 2, he was transfigured. Now, we don't really use the word transfigure in our daily life. It's not one of our words that we use nowadays. But we do use metamorphosis, maybe, or at least we read it. And we know what that means. And that word has the same root as transfigured. So we can think about that if we want to think about it in a little bit different way. Now, this was not something Jesus did to himself. It was something that happened to him. And his clothes became dazzling white. We also read about white robes elsewhere in the Bible, and it indicates usually a heavenly being like an angel or a righteous being. And it's this kind of description is particularly prevalent in the apocalyptic texts where they're talking about a future idealistic state. We don't usually wear white to church, but I think in Africa, maybe Hilda will know about this, sometimes I think they wear white on special days, kind of a signifying a holiness. Verse 3, suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah. Now, why Moses and Elijah and not, say, Samuel and Jeremiah or David and Job? Well, Moses and Elijah have the highest profile in the New Testament. They are each mentioned about 25 times. And they represent the law and the prophets. Obviously, Moses represents the law, but he also it was a prophet, and Elijah was a prophet, but also upheld the law. So they're both strong in each area. The other interesting thing about them is, and Enoch, is that they may not have experienced death. Elijah was taken up in a whirlwind and a cloud, and he didn't die, he was just away. Moses, it's very ambiguous at the end of Deuteronomy what happened to him. It depends how you translate it. He was buried, or God buried him. It doesn't say he died. So there was a tradition at the time of Jesus, and I think it lingers on today, that he didn't die. Both of them were associated with mountains and clouds, and I'm not going to go into all the symbolism with that, but there is a lot there too. Both of them suffered rebellion, rejection, and persecution, but they were not killed by their enemies. Now they were talking, and what was the subject of their conversation? And it doesn't tell us in Matthew, but in Luke it says they spoke about Jesus' departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Now, verse 4, Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here." And the word good in the Greek also had an original meaning of beautiful. And you can imagine this scene might have been pretty beautiful, definitely startling. Now, the three dwellings, I will make three dwellings here. In some versions, it's tents. I think maybe in the King James, I'm not sure. So we think of canvas or some kind of plastic tent. Well, they didn't have plastic back then. But what they would have done here would have been made a dwelling with leaves and branches. And there are three possible associations here. Who knows? That might have been in Peter's mind, or it might have been in the writer's mind that wrote this. The first is the Feast of Tents, and it might have been the Feast of Tents around that time. Don't really know. But if it was the Feast of Tents, then everybody, all six of them, should have had a tent. So that doesn't work out totally. Another association might have been the Tent of Meeting, and this is the Old Testament tabernacle that they had in the desert, and God commanded the Israelites to make this tent, this tabernacle, and Moses would sometimes go in there, but it's where God dwelt, and there would be a cloud over the top of it sometimes. And so there are a lot of associations there with the Tent of Meeting or the tabernacle. And the third kind of possible relationship would be to eternal dwelling places for the righteous in heaven. And, you know, Jesus said at one time, and I don't know if it was before this or after this, or maybe only in one of the Gospels, "I go to prepare a place for you. There's going to be a room there for you, a dwelling, a condo, whatever you want, whatever. There's a place, and it's an eternal dwelling. It's the end. It's supposed to be great." So there may have been that kind of association. Now, both Mark and Luke say something about Peter that doesn't get mentioned here in Matthew. Mark said Peter did not know what to say. They were so frightened. And Luke said Peter did not know what he was saying. But here in Matthew, he doesn't say that. But obviously, Peter was just working on his intuition here. And very quickly, what did he want to do with these little buildings he was going to make? Maybe he wanted to detain these two prophets, Moses and Elijah, and hear more of what they were saying. Would have been pretty interesting to see what they would say in the new context there. Maybe he wanted just to prolong the beautiful experience. Maybe he wanted to have a shortcut to the end times and conveniently skipping all the suffering. That would have been nice too. But in verse 5, we see that his suggestion was quickly rejected. And why was that? Now, one of the commentators that I read, proposed that the cloud overshadowed only Moses and Elijah, not Jesus and the three disciples. And it makes sense. but we don't really know. But it makes some sense because the voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved son." And if Jesus was hidden under the cloud, that wouldn't have been quite as relevant to the situation. So just assuming that the cloud only overshadowed Moses and Elijah, we would see Jesus in a different position from them, and it put him in a prominent position, and that position was reinforced by the words from the cloud. And the idea was to show Jesus in the context of the Old Testament tradition, but to highlight him in a special way. Now, the words, "This is my son, the beloved, with him I'm well pleased," they are familiar words from Jesus' baptism. But the additional wording here is "listen to him." And I was interested to see how Erica read that. She kind of had the emphasis on both the "listen" and "him." But it could be "listen to him" in contrast to listening to the Old Testament prophets. Or it could be "listen to him," you know, pay attention. And we don't know. Probably a bit of both. It's hard to know. So on verse 6, the disciples were afraid. In the three Gospels, the fear is, when they were afraid, is in three different places. In this, in Matthew, the voice caused them to fear. In Luke, they had fear when the cloud came, and in Mark, they had fear even before the cloud appeared. Probably their fear was increasing the whole time. And verse 7, this verse is unique in Matthew. It's not in Mark and Luke. Jesus came and touched them. And you can imagine, they had fallen down on the ground. They were probably hiding their eyes and trying to cover their ears and just make themselves as small as possible. But they still had because there was just too much sensory stimulus coming at them. But they could feel the touch of Jesus. And this touch shows the humanity of Jesus. In the previous verses, we see his divinity. Now we see his humanity, the actual physical part of him. And he says, "Do not be afraid." And that's another familiar quote from Jesus. And verse 8, when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. He probably didn't have these white garments shining so much anymore. So it was back to the ordinary world as they knew it. And verse 9, as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, "Tell no one about the vision." Now, sometimes when we use the word vision, we say, "Well, I have a vision for the future, Point Grey Fellowship," or something like that. Something inside our head that we have to interpret to other people. They don't see it. But this vision is something that these three disciples saw and experienced along with Jesus. It wasn't something they had to tell each other about. But they were asked to remain silent. Similar to what Jesus was telling them previously about the predictions of his suffering and death and so on. So I appreciated the litanies so far. They really helped in prayers. They help us understand this text. It's not an easy one to understand. And how do we approach it? And I've got some numerous ways here. They don't all work totally. So obviously the Gospels were written after the church started and after the theology had its beginnings. And they're not just a straight history, but they had a purpose in being written. And the first purpose, of course, is the apologetic purpose, trying to persuade people to become Christian. And they were trying to convince people of Jesus' divinity. So when we hear the words out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved son," that reinforces Jesus' divinity there. And biblical scholars like to take these passages and, you know, hone them down to what was the beginning wording, try to get back to the source of it and remove all the extraneous stuff. And so one commentator did that and got it down to its primitive version and said that it was designed to do two things. And the first one was to draw a parallel between Moses and Jesus' experience of God and probably their roles as mediators. And the second purpose was to heighten the authority and validate the status of the three pillars of the early church, Peter, James, and John. Of course, the passages do numerous things, but it was interesting that he came up with those two. Then there are the political aspects, and they had their issues in those days, as we have our issues with our theology and so on. Their big issue was, if you're Jewish and you're Christian, how much of the Jewish law do you follow? And Stephen was accused of wanting to drop all the Jewish law, and he was killed. So people remaining looked at that, and they became more moderate in their approach. So the transfiguration account puts Jesus into the context of the Jewish law while it profiles him as something different. And this account would really put a damper on people that wanted to continue all the Jewish traditions, because it really puts Jesus in a special position. And having three tenths, here's a reason why the three tenths wouldn't work, because it would have put all three on the same plane in kind of an equality. Another way to understand this passage a little bit more is to ask, why isn't the transfiguration account in the Gospel of John? And one of the commentators said that that's because all of the Gospel of John is a transfiguration account, and it pervades the entire book. We know John 1:14, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And sometimes we hear that worded as pitched his tent among us. So God's presence in John abides in the sacred tent or temple, which is Jesus himself. And the writer said, Jesus' flesh is a perpetual metamorphosis of God's glory. And then another way to think about why Peter's idea to build the three tents was quashed was because Jesus was already God's dwelling. So it doesn't make sense to put a dwelling on top of a dwelling. John 1:14 also states, and we beheld his glory. There's the idea of seeing the divine in Jesus, not necessarily as a one-time event. And I wanted to also look at a little bit more at the listen to him part. What were the disciples supposed to hear? The scriptures around this account have Jesus predicting his suffering, death, and resurrection, plus the suffering of his followers. Those who would come after me must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. The disciples heard Jesus' teaching, but they didn't comprehend, especially the resurrection part. And maybe that's why Jesus didn't want them to pass those teachings on at that point in time, when they didn't understand them anyway. But is there more? What are we supposed to hear? One commentator noted that the Matthew context is broader, and she states, the reference to a prophet like Moses underlies Matthew's gospel with its discourses and its focus on Jesus as the one who teaches the will of God and authenticates that teaching in his life. And a former bishop of London put it this way, the Lord's Prayer, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven, shows the kind of transformation we hope for, and the Sermon on the Mount shows the kind of character that will fit the Christian for it. And these ideas fit in very well with our Anabaptist way of looking at things. So another final approach. Commentators noted that the transfiguration account is both an epiphany and an apocalyptic account. As Protestant Christians in the 21st century, we're not well positioned to understand passages like these. As Anabaptists, it would be interesting to get some interpretation help from our non-Western brothers and sisters, but I wasn't able to do that. What we can do is go beyond our Anabaptist family, beyond our other Protestants, and beyond the Catholic part of our Christian family, namely to the Orthodox Christians. They declared it a major feast around 800 AD, and the Catholics declared it a feast in the 1400s in the Church of England in 1928. But in the latter two cases, it's only a minor feast, whereas with the Orthodox, it's a major feast. So how the Orthodox think about the light that happened in the Transfiguration could be helpful. They think of it as uncreated light. So it's not the sun, it's not the moon, it's not some star far off, it's not fire, it's not electricity. It's uncreated light of God, and it's a part of God's very self. It's neither material nor spiritual, and cannot be apprehended by the intellect alone. It reveals itself to the whole person. Obviously, there's more to the Transfiguration account than meets the ear. We heard, listen to him, but remember, prior to that, the disciples looked at Jesus in his luminous state, and we don't know for how long. Remember I talked about the video clip? Well, I think I'm back to that now. What may help us understand the Transfiguration better than our rational, analytical, Western approach is meditation with some of the Orthodox icons. And I looked at some of them on the web, and if people like, I can send out some links to a couple of them, because they do help understand the passage. I'd like to end by quoting from a book by somebody named Dorothy Lee, who grew up in Scotland and is now in Australia, a teacher of theology and writing. She's very good at both of those, I think. This is the last paragraph of her book. The symbols of the Transfiguration cross the divide, bringing together the apocalyptic and the epiphanic, spirit and matter, divinity and humanity, glory and suffering, beauty and terror, present and future, the old age and the new, human beings and creation. Greatest of all divisions, the Transfiguration, like the Incarnation on which it is based, crosses the otherwise impassable gulf between Creator and creation. The Transfiguration points back to the incarnation of the Divine Word and forward to the resurrection and the parousia. Through the enlivening presence of the Spirit, the revelation on the Holy Mountain unfolds the divinity and humanity of God before our eyes in light and beauty, giving eschatological form to our own humanity and divinity in Christ.